Welcome to The Point. I'm Sean Corcoran, news director at WCAI, and this is our weekly news roundup, when we discuss some of the top stories of the week with my colleagues in the print and digital media. Joining me here in our Woods Hole studio is Gwen Friss, an editor at the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online. Good morning, Gwen.
Good morning, Sean.
Welcome back to The Point. And joining us a little later will be Tim Wood, the editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Joshua Balling is calling in from the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. We hear from Jeff Spillane of the Mashpee Enterprise and Nelson Siegelman, editor of the Martha's Vineyard Times. Let's take a look at what's happening here on the Cape and the islands. Let's start with the Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station. It seems like Pilgrim has had a lot of mechanical problems over the past year and a half or so. And another one has cropped up, this one with the with an emergency cooling system, Gwen.
It has, and critics say this is just one more sign, as you mentioned, that the plant is aging and it's developing problems as it does so. Specifically, this time, what was found was that an electronic indicator that would help regulate the flow of coolant into the nuclear reactor during a serious accident was not functioning properly. And this malfunction is serious enough to require that a plant shut down if the problem isn't fixed within 14 days. So we'll be keeping an eye on that to see what happens next. But it's, you know, as I said, it's not part of the actual functioning, but it is an important thing because if you don't have that indicator, you wouldn't be able to control the situation should something go wrong.
Ah, so it's a backup system. If something went wrong, this would tell you how much coolant is going into the reactor to keep things cool.
Right, like a backup system and also a monitoring system so that you would have a better read on the situation, which definitely in the middle of an accident you would want to do.
So they have, what, 2 weeks to get this fixed?
Yep, 14 days under the NRC regulations.
Okay. Let's talk about President Obama and the First Family is on Martha's Vineyard. And, of course, Nelson Siegelman will be joining us later in the hour. He's on the ground there. But the Cape Cod Times, I've really enjoyed the coverage. You have reporters and photographers over there. It's taking a light look at what's been happening, how they've been occupying their time. In addition to all the news that's been happening nationally and internationally, which the president has had to respond to.
This has to be the newsiest presidential vacation that I've seen in a long time. And my personal memory goes back to the Clinton's visits. And of course, there are folks around here whose memories go back to when President Kennedy would come for the summer White House that he held here. There has been so much going on for the president, but he still has managed to play golf, I believe, three of the 4 days that he was there.
Okay.
And has some interesting partners. So I was going to mention before I forget to mention that if you like a real-time accounting of what's happening over there, we are tweeting the Obama vacation. So you could look at the hashtag MVObama. And, you know, from the Cape Cod Times, and you can see sort of, you know, hour-to-hour things that are happening with the president and his family.
So the Cape Cod Times is over there, and they have to be part of the pool of reporters, right? And the pool, do you know how the pool works?
I do. It may have changed, but I've been there before when it's been, I wasn't part of the pool. So if you're not, I can tell you better the perspective. If you are not part of the pool, you spend a lot of time kind of cruising the island because when I was there, I was covering then President Clinton, and he was spontaneous.
Yes.
So he would just show up someplace and you would be like looking one way and they would say, oh, he's at the mini golf course, you know. So there's always that to be considered. The other thing is that our video team is there. And for example, when the Obamas went out to one of their favorite restaurants, the Sweet Life Cafe in Oaks Bluffs, they were able to get some video of that again because we've done that before. And so you do get to see the lighter side. Now, the pool is covering a lot of the breaking news coverage that's coming out when they get together every morning, as well as of course, going to the golf courses. So I don't know if that answers your question.
No, it does. And the pool has been really important as there has been breaking news in the evenings. And so sometimes there's a rotation, I think. So sometimes it
yes.
could be someone from the Washington Post who's filing, and then it could be someone from the Cape Cod Times who's in charge of filing for that particular amount of time.
And there are specific press folks who travel with the president, so they're also there. And it's once again, I believe, at the Edgartown School that the pool is the press corps is set up, and we go from there.
And we'll hear from Nelson. He always has interesting things to say about the presidential vacations, and he'll be at the end of the hour.
Well, before we move on, though, I did want to say that you can also watch videos to get a peek of the president playing golf. And he's not a lightweight, you know, in addition to policymakers that he's playing golf with. He's also playing golf with some former sports players. And I think that we have a list of who's getting FaceTime with the president.
Let's hear the list. I know Ray Allen was over, the former Celtic, yes.
That's absolutely true. Ahmad Rashad. Did I say that properly?
I think so.
A sportscaster and former professional football player. Mm-hmm. And this is where you see my weakness, because I don't follow sports as closely as I should. But as you said, Ray Allen. And then, of course, there's some folks that the president has known for years. Dr. Eric Whitaker, who he knew back in Chicago, and former U.S. Trade Ambassador Ron Kirk.
Oh, and, sure.
Cyrus Walker, who's a cousin of the senior White House advisor and an Oaks Bluffs resident. So that's just some of the people that you can see him playing golf with.
And it was interesting that there was a party at Vernon Jordan's home that not only did the Obamas attend, but also the Clintons.
Yes, it must be the hug that was heard around the world, but not seen as far as I know. You know, they said this was going to be a private thing. She was there to attend that. That party was an 80th birthday party for Ann Jordan, Vernon Jordan's wife.
Right.
And she was there to sign her book. And also she had called the president to smooth some things over about some criticism that she had offered. And she said, you know, it's just kind of an all in the family sort of thing. But she wanted to hug it out. So I can't say for sure if she did. So.
Okay. Let's talk about what's happening in the town of Sandwich, where there have been dueling developments going on for an area of Sandwich. Two companies went before the Board of Selectmen this week. It's kind of a developing story because there was a story earlier in the week, and now we're hearing that the selectmen seem to be supportive of a large youth sports complex development in town, though there are still some questions, I guess, about wastewater.
Well, one of the really interesting things about these evaluations that were done by a 12-member team from Sandwich, including two selectmen, is that they're public, and normally these kinds of negotiations are not. So we got to see a little bit more. George Brennan was there, and we got to see a bit more than we might have otherwise. And as you mentioned earlier, it's the Clark Consulting Group, which is talking about sports fields and a field house and other youth-based activities. The evaluators also spoke with, and I believe it's Sakalas Realty Trust, and they are interested in a shopping center. It would be a fourth shopping center in that area that they would be building. They own three already. So that's pretty much where things are at for right now. But we're hoping that this evaluation process will continue to be in the public eye, and then we can see exactly how it's all coming down instead of seeing a product at the end.
There's been a lot of reporting around this and some detailed information about the proposal specifically, and the sports complex is really, really interesting, this youth sports complex. And but then I noticed in the paper there, some people were saying, well, but we're the museum town, you know, the Glass Museum and the Heritage Museum and Gardens. So I thought that was interesting that they think of how some of the leadership in Sandwich thinks of itself as the museum town when they're considering whether a different type of development that could clearly attract a lot of tourists.
Well, I have two thoughts on that come from stories that were in the paper, one today. I think some other folks, you know, generally think of a Sandwich in that way as well. In the lifestyle section, we have a story about vacationing at home if you live here.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly what one of our people said was, you know, that she sees Sandwich as a museum town.
Huh.
But on the other side of that, having covered Sandwich many years ago, I know that there was a constant need for things for young people to do. Because seriously, if you live in Sandwich, there's a movie theater now, but where do you go to hang out. You know, since the days that I covered it, they have a movie theater and they have the high school's facilities out front, you know, for their park. But it's a long question is that where do young people go to hang out, to do things? I think Hyannis has been very successful with their youth center.
Oh, it's fairly new, the youth center there. Yes, it's remarkable.
Amazingly busy. If you look at their calendar, there are no white spaces at all. They totally book their calendar.
And let's talk about what's happening on Nantucket in terms of veterans. There will be more care for veterans on Nantucket. It can be very isolated on Nantucket.
This is, in a long stretch here, this is sort of related to the president because he had been talking about improving veterans care throughout the country, and this is one way that he may be able to do that. Right now, veterans, if they want their free care, have to leave the island to get it, and this is an agreement that's being worked out which would allow them to visit a local care center there for certain things so that they would be able to, they wouldn't have to pay for their care, they'd be able to get see a doctor there on the island. And, you know, obviously, I think they talked to someone who had smashed his thumb with a hammer. That's not when you want to get on the ferry. So it would be very helpful to them to have that kind of care on the island. And that's, as I understand it, still in the works, but the agreement is close to being inked.
So any time frame at all?
I'm not sure, actually. I would have to
That's okay.
find out a little bit more about that.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to be joined by Tim Wood, the editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle. One of the stories we're going to be speaking about with Tim Wood is in regards to Chatham Bars Inn in the town of Chatham, which are at odds over a piece of land and what's going to be happening with that. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup on WCAI when we discuss the top news stories of the week. I'm Sean Corcoran. With me in our Woods Hole studio is Gwen Friss. She's an editor at the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online. Joining us on the phone is Tim Wood. He's the editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle, which is located in the town of Chatham. Good morning. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning, Sean.
Thanks for joining us. Let's talk about this story with Chatham Bars Inn. We've been talking about it. We've watched this story develop over the past year about a conflict regarding a piece of land. And this, I was reading some of the news reports this week. It looks like this battle might have been shaping up for potentially decades, looking back at some of the history.
Yeah, it's gone back and forth for quite a number of years, and it involves about a 10,000 square foot chunk of land located at the town's fish pier. If you want to go way back, it's in 1956. The then owners of the inn deeded some property to the town, which is where part of the parking area and a dock at the fish pier are located now. And since about that time, the town has leased this other portion of CBI property for parking at the fish pier. It's used by commercial fishermen who work out of the pier. Now, back in 2006, new owners took over the inn, and the town began negotiating with them over a more permanent use agreement for that property. But it was more difficult than it sounded. CBI wanted to swap some town-owned land by the Seaside Links Golf Course, which they could use for parking for this property. Those negotiations did not go well and fell through. The latest agreement expired for use of the lower level at the fish pier parking area. That expired in June. And this past week, CBI filed suit in land court to block taking of that property that had been voted at the May annual town meeting. The town voted to take a use easement in the property, not to actually take the property, but to take a use easement in that property. Now, CBI is saying that move to take that property would serve no valid public purpose. They're saying it would only expand parking for commercial businesses that use the town facility down at the pier, such as charter boats and seal watches, water taxis, and commercial fishermen. But officials in town and fishermen say that that parking has to be protected, that it's critical to the infrastructure there and critical for the commercial fishermen who operate out of the pier. And there's, I think, nearly 100 docking permits issued to commercial fishermen down at the pier there. So The issue right now where it sits is there's a hearing scheduled for September 17th. CBI is asking the court to issue an injunction to stop the selectmen from moving ahead with that easement taking. That could be problematic because selectmen are scheduled this coming Tuesday, the 19th, they've scheduled a public hearing to actually vote that easement. And Chairman of the Selectmen, Florence Selden, told me yesterday that that vote is on the agenda. It could be postponed, but she wasn't offering any assurances that it would be postponed. So we're going to be watching that meeting closely to see how that goes.
And, of course, Chatham Bars Inn is a major player in Chatham. Generally speaking, what's the relationship like right now between the town, outside of this particular issue, between the town and the inn? Have there been disagreements about tax assessments or other issues that have come up, or mostly is it pretty positive?
It's been mostly positive for a number of years now. The new owner of the inn has had a few entanglements regarding zoning and some other issues, but nothing that's really hurt the sort of a business community relationship between the inn and the town. It's pretty cordial. The inn does a lot for the business community and for the community in general, hosting a number of events and making contributions. So I think it's kind of, this issue is really the most acrimonious thing that's going on between the inn and the town at this point. And of course, I lost my train of thought there, but
that's okay.
This issue has really been at the center of any sort of controversy in recent years.
Okay, let's talk about another story that also has been ongoing, going back to, I think it was, the last Super Bowl, when a gentleman in Chatham decided to go out and do a little work in the wetlands area near his home?
Exactly. You may remember that happened back Super Bowl Sunday, I believe last February. Sears Point property owner David Rogers took a small skid steer, which is like a little bobcat-type machine, onto his beach on State Harbor, and sort of sheared away a lot of beach and marsh and shellfish, whatever else was out there, before the machine got stuck in the muck out there, and he left it in the flats as the tide came in, and it was discovered the next morning sort of sitting out in the water. That incident was done without permits, and it resulted in more than a dozen wetland violations and a fine of $33,000, plus an order to restore those wetland resources. A few weeks ago, a conservation department inspector was out at Mr. Rogers' property to inspect some driveway work going on there, and that resulted in another stop work order. The driveway work, according to the town, was being done not in accordance with the permit that he had. The town had issued a permit to relocate the driveway, which is about 30 feet from a wetland area. But the new driveway was to have a pervious surface, which generally here means crushed shell, gravel, stone, something of that sort. Mm-hmm. The inspector out there found that they were pouring concrete onto the driveway. And now Mr. Rogers and his attorney say the concrete was a pervious type of concrete that is actually better than gravel, lasts longer, and allows water to percolate through so that it doesn't run off into the wetland. The Conservation Commission is not sure about that. They were upset because they weren't notified that that work was being done sort of outside of the scope that had been discussed. They had his attorney into their meeting on Wednesday and voted to require that Mr. Rogers file an amendment to his original permit and bring in evidence that this is actually pervious concrete that was being poured there, as well as a maintenance plan and plans showing exactly how the work is being done. The Conservation Commission members say they've never seen a pervious concrete used in town before, so they're really looking for information as to whether it works or not. There have been some information and videos that they saw from outside of the area that seem to indicate that it does do the job, but they're a little skeptical right now. Meanwhile, the fine that Mr. Rogers had incurred from the February incident still hasn't been paid. He's appealed that to the court and is awaiting a hearing, and likewise, the restoration plan is still awaiting final approval. So there's really been no no work done on that property to lead to progress towards restoring those wetlands.
I thought I remembered that he was very apologetic about what happened to those wetlands and seemed willing to do whatever the Conservation Commission wanted. So it's kind of surprising to hear that the fines haven't been paid and he's challenging those. Did I have that wrong? Has the tenor changed?
No, I don't think so. He's been cooperative. I think they're the fine issue. I'm sure he doesn't want to shell out that much money for
sure.
An issue. As far as the plan is concerned, I know they've been arguing or negotiating over specifics. It's a very complicated matter. Some of the to replace the salt marsh, the grass has to be started growing off-site and then replanted, and it's a very complicated process. And I believe right now it's sort of up at the state level where they're reviewing it to determine exactly how it should proceed. He's certainly sunk a lot of money into developing the plan, hiring experts and engineers, and the plan itself is going to cost quite a bit of money, whatever the final negotiations end up. So, I did talk to Mr. Rogers this week about the latest issue, and he was a little befuddled about why they weren't allowing the pervious concrete, which he said he's been assured is fine. He's a little he's a little gun shy right now. He thinks there's a little
he's
ganging
in the spotlight
up on him at this point.
Yeah.
And his attorney said the same thing at Wednesday's meeting, but the commission is sort of adamant that they want this stuff done right, and we'll see how it goes. I think he'll probably end up coming back in a couple of weeks with what they ask, and if it meets their requirements, the work will probably be allowed to proceed.
Okay. Tim Wood is the editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle. You can follow Tim and the Cape Cod Chronicle newsroom on Twitter at CCC Newsroom. Tim, thank you.
Thanks, Sean.
Appreciate it. Let's go to Josh Balling. He is the assistant editor of the Nantucket Inquirer Mirror, as well as the director of digital content at the Inky Mirror. Good morning, Josh.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us. Let's talk about Nantucket's funeral home situation, which we've discussed before. Now, there is, at this present time, no funeral home on Nantucket. Why? How long has it been that way?
It has been that way since December of 2013, when the Lewis Funeral Home, which is a family-run funeral home on Nantucket, the only one for over 100 years, closed its doors. Ricky Lewis, the town's funeral director, was retiring. He was in his 80s. And the family attempted to sell it to either an on-island party or one of the funeral homes or funeral home groups from off-island, and there really wasn't much interest. The funeral home took care of about 100 funerals a year, and both the Lewis family and those that even took a look at the business said that is just unfortunately not enough to sustain a business, especially on an island like Nantucket with the high cost of living and the high cost of doing business. So they closed in December of 2013, and the home was sold. The building was sold to a group who converted it back into a private home. And since then, islanders who have lost loved ones have had to have their relatives, their family members' bodies prepared on the mainland. And as you can imagine, especially in the off-season, that can lead to not only added expense, but delays, weather-related problems. There was one woman earlier this year who had her mother pass away, and it was over a month before all the final preparations could be taken care of, funerals, services, because of transportation delays and other issues. So right now it looks, however, like there have been some changes at the state level. A home rule petition was passed, and right now Nantucket could have a funeral home very, very soon in the future.
So who had to approve that? How did that? What was the process to get a nonprofit funeral home? And is that a common thing?
As far as we can tell, it's very uncommon. Again, Nantucket is in a unique situation on the mainland. That's not necessarily an issue. There are funeral homes. Every few towns perhaps has one, and you are not isolated from a funeral home. What actually happened was the home rule petition exempted the island from some of the state's funeral regulations. It did not require the towns to have a funeral director have an ownership stake in the funeral home. Did not require the town to have a chapel attached to the funeral home, and a couple of other regulations intended to provide a quality of service and regulation to the funeral home industry in general. But those things just simply didn't work on Nantucket, given the small scale and size. So what will happen now is a nonprofit or not-for-profit group will own the funeral services a building. It will not be a funeral home. There will not be a chapel. There will not be a religious affiliation in any way. But a funeral director will be hired. The building will be constructed. An island contractor has pledged to build the funeral services building at cost for Nantucket on town-owned land that will be approved at town meeting or asked to be approved at town meeting for voters.
Right.
And that will happen, you know, out here. So the issue that's been going on for over a year now, islanders will not have to take the bodies of their loved ones and family members off-island to have that added expense and extra time.
One trend we've seen here in the Cape, anecdotally anyway, is that more families are handling funeral arrangements themselves, preparing the body at home and having wakes at home and that type of thing. Anecdotally, have you seen that on the island, especially in light of the lack of a funeral?
I think there's been something of a tradition of that in general on the island.
Mm-hmm.
A number of the the houses of worship also provide the spaces for wakes and funeral services. And Nantucket, obviously, a long-standing independent streak and tradition out here, isolated out on the island. But even those issues, the bodies still have to be prepared professionally, and they would have to be taken off island. A number of off-island funeral service companies have been, more than accommodating, but simply the logistics of travel make it difficult. One of the funeral homes on the Cape has put up a vehicle over here so they can help with transportation of bodies. That way they can just get their people back and forth a little bit quicker than having to take the traditional ferry of 2.5 hours. But it is a concern, it is a constraint, and this whole issue was spearheaded by Town Clerk Catherine Flanagan Stover, who actually has a funeral services degree. She's not intending to change jobs anytime soon, but she understands the circumstances, and at a difficult time, anything that can make it easier on the families is certainly a welcome thing.
What else is in the news? What else is being talked about on Nantucket this week?
Oh, definitely another big story, the Veterans Affairs New England Healthcare System announced this week that plans are in the works to partner with Nantucket Cottage Hospital to provide some basic services to island veterans, saving them, again, the expense and delay of expensive day-long or longer trips to the outpatient clinic in Hyannis or even the VA hospital in Providence or Brockton. There are 148 veterans on Nantucket. Many of them say that it's sometimes too costly to try to get to the mainland for care, the free care that they deserve and are entitled to for being veterans. And they pay for their medical expenses out of pocket instead. And what looks like what might be happening now and coming close to an agreement wherein Nantucket Cottage Hospital will provide that care from the Veterans Services, Veterans Healthcare Administration, to veterans out here on Nantucket, saving them, again, that expense and the travel time.
Mm. Yeah, we talked about that a little earlier. Interesting story, and it's good to have those veterans being taken care of. Again, the isolation of Nantucket comes into play there. Josh Balling is the assistant editor of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror and the director of digital content at the Inky Mirror, and you can follow Josh on Twitter at JBallingIM. Thank you, Josh. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right. And let's see. I want to see, is Jeff Spillane ready to go? Yes, we're going to talk with Jeff Spillane right now. He's a reporter at the Mashpee Enterprise Newspapers. Good morning, Jeff.
Hey, good morning, Sean. How are you?
I'm doing well. It seems to be the morning that we're talking about stories that have been kind of hanging on for a while, and you have one this morning about an oyster farmer in Mashpee who's been trying to get access to some shellfish beds to actually work those that area, but he's been confronted at every turn by neighbors.
That's right. And as you mentioned, the story that's been hanging on, this is now in its fourth year, Sean. And the latest in a long string of court decisions was issued late last week. We found out about it on Monday morning. But the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court decided last week that they were not even going to hear the latest case that was brought forth against the town of Mashpee and Richard Cook, who's a shellfisherman here in town. And that particular case was regarding the Cape Cod Commission, where the homeowners in Pompanesset Island and Daniels Island said, gee, this could be a project of regional impact, so it should be have to go through the regulatory process of the Cape Cod Commission. Supreme Judicial Court says, nah, you know what, we're not even going to hear that, and threw it right out, which means that the opposition of the oyster farm is now 0-6 in court cases.
So let's back up just for a second. So the town of Mashpee is in on this case, and in addition to the shell fishermen. So neighbors are fighting both because it was the town of Mashpee that approved the permitting for him to go in there and start to shellfish.
Exactly. It was the Board of Selectmen who gave their approval. the Conservation Commission, and the Zoning Board of Appeals. And all three of those boards have been named in these cases.
And folks will remember that this case really exploded around here when it was an off-Cape legislator, a Representative Costello out of Newburyport, I believe, who was the one who slipped something into some legislation at the State House that would have made this area, the exact dimensions of this shellfishing area, off limits to shellfishing. And I guess, if you I remember correctly, it was done at the behest of the neighbors.
Yes, it was. Charles Clough, who is a resident of Daniels Island Road, he used his lobbying firm, ML Strategies in Boston, to work with Representative Costello. And, of course, that didn't make it into the final state budget. Senator Wolf and Representative Hara made sure of that.
You know, hi, Jeff. It's Gwen Friss from the Cape Cod Times.
Gwen.
How are you?
Terrific.
I was going to mention when we were talking about how long this story has been around and its complicated history that when I read the latest story, I was glad to see that on our website, and I think probably on yours as well, that there's a listing of the stories that have gone before. So if you are interested and you want to catch up, it's not like the old days when you had to go dig through a lot of newspaper clippings. You can simply click on the related stories because they're all laid out together. So,
and Jeff, there's been a lot of reaction to this. I think probably because locals and people who have been around the Cape for a while say, look, this is what happens on Cape Cod. There's shell fishing here. If you don't like it, maybe you shouldn't live next to the water.
That's right. That's right. And even the Wampanoag tribe here in Mashpee, this is part of our sustenance. This is part of our culture. Take a look over in Martha's Vineyard off of Wellesley, Dennis. You're right, Sean. This is what happens here on the Cape. And if some of these decisions in the court would have gone the other way, it could really have had an impact on shellfishing throughout the country. I've spoken to shellfish farmers all up and down the East Coast who have been watching this very closely.
Interesting. Let's talk about another story that the Mashpee Enterprise has been covering, and that's it's under discussion in the town of Mashpee to have a split between residential taxes, what residents would pay, year-round residents would pay for a tax rate, versus what summer or seasonal residents would pay. And this also is an issue that's I'm seeing in other communities. Provincetown comes to mind, a discussion happening there as well.
It is. This was proposed by our new selectman who took office in May, Andy Gottlieb. It was part of his campaign to reduce taxes for year-round residents here in town. It's under the Massachusetts General Law, which would allow a town to provide up to a 20% exemption from taxes for a residential property that was owner-occupied. And it would shift that 20%, up to 20% tax burden to seasonal residents or people who had just second homes here and rented them out. Has certainly been a cause of quite a bit of controversy here in town since it was proposed. So the Board of Selectmen, after commissioning a working group to take a look at this, decided, well, you know, a lot of the people who are upset about this and have concerns about it would be our summer residents. So let's have a public hearing in the summer. Mm-hmm. And that will happen on Monday evening at Mashpee High School. Grab a bag of popcorn. It should be a pretty exciting show. and what will happen is the town assessor will give a presentation with some of his findings, and then the meeting will be open to the public to comment on it. But some of the information that has come back from an initial study of this is that it's not something that can be done overnight. I'm hearing estimates of 1 to 3 years for something like this to be implemented. There would need to be new software put in place, new employees hired in town. Somebody that you mentioned, this could be an administrative nightmare.
Hmm. That's surprising because other communities, it's not uncommon at all to shift the tax burden over to the business side of the ledger mm-hmm. in a community. And when I've covered Board of Selectmen's, I haven't seen that being a huge issue as they do that.
Yeah, well, you know, Mashpee every year takes a look at shifting the burden to businesses, and each year has decided not to, simply because it really would make a big difference here, and they do want to promote some economic development. Mm-hmm. This, I believe, is the first time they've taken a look at seriously considering a residential tax exemption.
Okay. Good information. Thanks, Jeff Spillane. He's a reporter at the Mashpee Enterprise, and you can follow Jeff on Twitter at GEOFF Spillane. That's Jeff Spillane. Thank you, sir. Appreciate it.
Hey, have a great weekend.
You too. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Nelson Siegelman will join us. We'll talk a little bit more about the presidential vacation. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup on WCAI when we discuss the top news stories of the week. I'm Sean Corcoran. With me in our Woods Hole studio is Gwen Friss, a reporter at, an editor at the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online, a former reporter at the Cape Cod Times, of course. Right,
that's
Gwen?
That's quite a... All right, Sean, because I still do quite a bit of reporting as well. So
of course.
That's fine.
In journalism, you do it all these days, from photography to video to reporting, the whole thing.
Absolutely.
Nelson Siegelman is on the phone. He's the editor at the Martha's Vineyard Times. Good morning, Nelson.
Editor, reporter, photographer, we do it all.
It's true.
That's right, Nelson. We show up and do it all.
Have you been out and about and enjoying the Obama vacation and the coverage around that? And, of course, potential presidential candidate Hillary Rodham Clinton also on the island this week, Nelson.
Yes, it was a very busy week. There are a lot of people. I heard, there was a party Wednesday night for Vernon Jordan's wife, and I was talking to a police officer, and he told me the most difficult thing about the evening was juggling all the motorcades pulling in, because you had Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton, and you had President Obama and his wife, and you had Eric Holder, and you had Valerie Jarrett and other people whom I just can't remember their names. Mm-hmm. They all came with their own variety of security. So it was a rockin' party, too, I heard.
Yeah. How else have you been covering the vacation? I mean, you've done this many times now.
Oh, yeah. I can certainly recall covering Clinton's visits and also, obviously, President Obama's visits. This is his fifth time as president, and he also visited here before he was president. So the vineyard is attractive to them, I suppose, for the same reasons that it attracts many families who come here. It's a pretty place in the summer, and they have a lot of their friends here, and they do many of the things everybody else does. They go to the beach, and in Mr. Obama's case, he plays a lot of golf.
Right. And have you seen the family? I know the family enjoys going over to Oak Bluffs quite a bit.
Well, I haven't. I have to admit, I do my best to avoid all these motorcades and hubbub, so I try to stay out of the crowds. But I know that Michelle Obama has been pretty low-key. She went into Edgartown for lunch and met some friends. That was on, I believe, Tuesday afternoon. That caused a bit of a traffic jam in Edgartown, but you know what? Traffic jams in Edgartown and Oak Bluffs in August are really nothing unusual. I think it just amps up the degree of the traffic jam.
Yeah, unfortunately, a lot of people don't realize just what a great transportation system we have on the island. You really don't need to bring your car unless it's a supply situation, I would imagine.
Right, there's a great bus system. It can get you around, so certainly, there's no need for a car, although I suppose if you're going to the beach, it's nice to be able to load everything up and just arrive with that. But there certainly, for example, Menemcha is very crowded in the evening, and the selectmen there established a shuttle service to try and mitigate some of the congestion, although it doesn't seem to be working very well yet because people still, I suppose, everyone thinks, well, I'll find a parking place, and then they end up just driving around and getting frustrated and yelling at the other people with New York and Connecticut.
Okay. I know where this is going. Let's quickly talk about this Martha's Vineyard youth philanthropic organization that's helping out with the youth here. I think the youth on the island get forgotten sometime. I mean, well, people forget it's a real year-round community here.
It is a real year-round community with all the problems any small year-round community might have, and of course with the added dimension that we're somewhat isolated, particularly in the winter. We just have a ferry, and it's hard for kids to do a lot of the activities that mainland kids might do. But having said that, both the year-round and seasonal community is very generous, and they do a lot to contribute to organizations here, and this is the latest example. This organization was started by two seasonal men, Dan Stanton and Jim Schwartz, and they've come up with an interesting model. Rather than creating an organization and appealing to people every summer in the big sort of summer fundraising type of event, what they did is they went to 40 vineyard families, and they've asked them each to commit $25,000 annually. and in this way fund this new organization, MV Youth, with the idea that it's going to be run very sort of lean. They have one administrator, and every year their plan is to disperse at least $1 million and to different organizations and for scholarships on the island. And what they said is there are a lot of new people moving the island, younger people who naturally would like to become involved and give to charitable organizations, and this is a different kind of model where these people make a commitment of a significant amount, and then the organization, MV Youth, knows what they're going to have in their budget to disperse. So we'll see where it goes, but it's a we're very lucky on Martha's Vineyard, I think, to have seasonal residents like this who are willing to step up and contribute and try and help the community.
Nelson Siegelman is the editor of the Martha's Vineyard Times. He joins us on the Roundup every Friday. Thank you, Nelson.
You're welcome.
Have a great weekend. And Gwen Friss is here. She's an editor at the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online. She joins us in our Woods Hole studio. Let's talk about this gas line in Sandwich briefly. This is a high-pressure gas line that's been under discussion for years in town. Some neighbors of the – it's going to be along the north side of the service road, which kind of parallels Route 6. So some neighbors heard about this, and they were concerned. They've been trying to fight it, but it looks like it's going to happen.
Well, I have to say, you were speaking earlier, Sean, about how stories have been around forever, and this falls into that category as well. National Grid has been trying since 2006 to put in a bigger line so that they can deliver more gas to the Mid and Lower Cape. And this is a part of that line. The whole line would be 13.1 miles, and the part that's in Sandwich is a 4.4 mile stretch along, as you said, where the service road is. And I don't know if I'd say that they're there yet, but they got a big decision from the state in terms of the state okaying this. And as I said, they've been trying since 2006, but the neighbors really became aware of it just a couple of years ago when the Cape Cod Commission got in on doing a review of the project, and it brought it sort of home and made it a lot more public at that point. The state has said that they can do it, but now the National Grid is looking to do some mitigation for the neighbors who are saying, hey, we have some concerns, you know. One is safety, and another is the fact that if you cut down the trees to put this pipeline in, you're going to be exposing us, you know, I don't know if you know the area, Sean, but they would be exposed right to the Route 6 traffic, which brings noise and distraction. So that's the next step, and National Grid is offering to replant the trees that they take down in order to put the pipe in. And they also, the next step is for National Grid to get town approval to clear those trees, because this is a multi-step process.
Of course.
And so there's a hearing scheduled for August 25th, I believe, at Town Hall. And they'll be talking about what that will do to the neighborhood and what mitigation can be done. So I imagine there will be future hearings as well for people who have questions about the public safety aspects of it.
The Barnstable Land Trust, which is a group in Barnstable that works to get hold of properties before it can be developed and keep them preserved. I just want to mention this briefly. It's on the front page of today's Cape Cod Times. You can read about this. And, of course, people in area of Kootuat know about this story because there's some land that's near the Lowell Park in Kootuat. That's the home of the Kootuat Kettleers. That's the Cape Cod Baseball League team that's based in Kootuat. 19 acres there that surround the park, and there's a portion of the outfield that's actually a part of that that private property. I guess the outfield is kind of expanded over the years onto some private property. Well, now that private property is for sale. The land trust is attempting to get hold of it and trying to cobble together the funds for that. Seems like the family that owns it wants the land to be preserved. So we'll continue to follow that story. People say that it really could change the entire feel of that park, which is one of the better parks in the Cape Cod Baseball League system. system. Let's move on to a dedication of Veterans Memorial Bridge. That's the one that crosses over Route 6 at Route 132. Now, that's a dedication there to a U.S. Navy SEAL who was killed in Afghanistan.
They say that whenever Kevin Houston saw the American flag, that really big American flag that towers over the exit 6 at Route 6, that he knew he was home. And it's really fitting then that that overpass has been dedicated to him. He is a Navy SEAL who was killed in 2011 when he and 37 others were heading to reinforce a unit of U.S. Army Rangers, and they were shot down with a rocket-propelled grenade in Afghanistan. And Houston was a 1994 graduate of Barnstable High School, was 35 when he died. At Saturday's ceremony, it was really almost an unveiling, not only of a monument, but memories of his life, because some of his friends were there, talked about some of the good things they did, some of the mischievous things they did. It was very warm service. And there were some words from his mother, and his mom is Jeanette Anderson, that really struck a chord for me. I thought that they were both prophetic and moving when she said that the worst fear for a mother when they, this is a quote, the worst fear for a mother when they lose their child is that they will be forgotten, Houston's mother, Jeanette Anderson, said. And after she said that after the event, and she also said, Kevin will never be forgotten, and that's huge. I know I travel that way all the time, and I'll think about him, you know, as I'm going past. I think that this tribute, this sign that, you know, maybe in generations someone will say, I wonder who Kevin Houston was, but there'll be that piece of history to remember him by.
That's wonderful, and those are beautiful words. I'm glad you read that. I understand there might be another dedication for another soldier who died?
Yes, this is a fallen Marine. I wanted to mention this. I believe his family is doing this, but a horseback riding arena in East Falmouth will be dedicated Friday, today, tonight, in honor of Captain Eric A. Jones. And he was a Marine who was killed in Afghanistan in October of 2009. And the dedication, if anyone wants to go, is from 5:30 to 7 p.m. at Smithfield Farm, 809 Sandwich Road in East Falmouth. Jones' parents, Cynthia and Kenneth Jones of Mashpee, they fund an equine therapy program at the farm for military families through their Heroes in Transition program. And that's done in their son's memory. It helps the children of military families who are struggling to use this particular therapy with horses.
You know, when I first saw someone dump a bucket of ice water over their head about 2 weeks ago online, I really didn't think we'd be talking about it on the news roundup. But it's really turned into something. And one of the stories I did like in the paper this week was about a teacher who has ALS. And, of course, this ice water bucket challenge or whatever they're calling it. Is in honor of people with ALS, and there's usually they're asking you to make a donation to ALS research. But there's a teacher who has ALS, and now they're doing this ice bucket challenge in honor of him.
Well, I have to tell you, before we move into that story, that this is a real water cooler, no pun intended, topic at my office, because we often say this is a great thing, but, you know, is anyone really thinking about ALS? Because so many of those that you see on the internet, there's no explanation of why they're dumping the ice water over their heads. So there have been a couple of stories, and this one about Mr. K is very important in explaining why people are doing this. This is a science teacher, Wally Kittredge, at DeForest Dale School. He taught generations of children, and we interviewed him, and he talked a little bit about how this will help. There's also the Falmouth.
I'm sorry
about that.
But folks can go online and read that story.
Right.
It's a very touching story.
It is.
Gwen, thank you so much. Gwen is an editor at the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online. Joined us here in our Woods Hole studio, and we appreciate it. You can follow Gwen on Twitter at DailyRecipeCCT. Thank you, Gwen.
Thank you.
Thanks to our other contributors, Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle, Josh Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer Mirror, Jeff Spillane of the Mashpee Enterprise, and Nelson Siegelman of the Martha's Vineyard Times. And thank you so much for listening. I'm Sean Corcoran.